This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and to help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 97 of Metatrex, Trek FM's show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me as always is Mike Morrison. Today, we are going to be discussing the various philosophical themes in the first season of Star Trek Picard, which just ended a few days ago. Mike, it's great to be recording.
It is great to be recording, Zachary. I have been looking forward to this for a while. Like a lot of fans, I just... really was excited about Star Trek Picard. And as soon as this wrapped, I said, you know, we've been talking about needing to get on mic for a while. And this just gave us a great excuse. And of course, with everything going on in the world, it's nice to be able to sit down and just kind of escape for a little while and talk Star Trek.
Well, you've been busy working on your second novel.
Yes.
But after every episode of Star Trek Picard, I would send you a message on Facebook saying, hey, next time we get around to doing Metatrex, we got to talk about Picard. So here we are. The season is over and we're actually going to do it.
Yeah. And I don't think we have to give spoiler alerts since the season is already wrapped. But I'm going to give one anyway. So if you have not seen all of the episodes of Star Trek Picard, you need to hit the pause button, go watch Star Trek Picard, and then come back and catch the rest of this podcast.
Yeah, if you haven't watched the season, why are you listening to us? Go watch Picard and come back.
Yeah, totally.
I have to say, I was really impressed with the first season of Picard. It started off a little slowly for me, but as I was putting together my list of topics for us to talk about, we're not going to dive into a lot of depth. We're going to talk about the overall themes and some examples, some things we can dive into in future episodes of Metatrex in more depth. I came up with a surprisingly long list for a short season of only 10 episodes.
Yeah, and I have to say, you and I have been talking kind of back and forth on Messenger and sending messages to one another, and this is a great list. I think that gives us a nice bird's eye view of some of the major philosophical themes here in this first season of Star Trek Picard. And something that you and I have both resolved to do a little bit more of as we go forward with Metatrex is really doing a better job of incorporating all of this wonderful new Star Trek content that we've been getting into Metatrex. So I know that we'll be talking a lot more about Star Trek Picard in future episodes, because I have to say, Zachary, they really gave us, in my honest opinion, I think the perfect follow-up to The Next Generation. This was such a well-written, well-done. Like you, I think early on there were some things that just didn't quite set right with me in some of the early episodes. There were some things that I thought looked familiar, if you will, and not always in good ways. There was a kind of a B storyline that I just kind of destroyed really how I felt in some of those early episodes. All of this good stuff going on in A plot and then this B plot, and I'm going to just say it, the Borg cube stuff, just wasn't doing it for me. It wasn't interesting. I didn't feel like it was well written. I almost feel like they could have just pulled it out all of it almost, and told the story without all of that kind of minutia, if you will. And philosophically, it wasn't very engaging for me. It just didn't interest me in any way. But then all of this stuff with Data and the Android, and for me too, getting Picard, you know, this much older, jaded version of arguably one of the greatest heroes in Star Trek. Now we're seeing him much older in life, and he's wiser, but he's a little jaded. And I think that there's some really interesting things going on. I don't want to get too far into it because I want to talk about it later, but I think there's some really interesting things going on with him in very early episodes, the first 3-4 episodes, some really interesting themes that really caught me in particular, a little off guard as an older guy. You know, I'm starting to think about, what life is going to look like as I get older. I'm pushing 50, and, you know, I'm starting to think about, you know, the 60s and 70s, and, you know, hopefully I live to be in the 80s and 90s. Certainly, you know, Picard here is in his 90s, and I hope I make it to that point, but I'm starting to think about what life's going to look like then. And so this raised a lot of really interesting ideas for me philosophically and emotionally that I think's worth exploring.
I think one of the biggest dangers in life, in podcasting, in television production, in any number of different areas, is looking backwards instead of looking forward. And we could do that philosophically by looking at the history of philosophy, like, oh, this is the history of philosophy, and it culminates in today, and it's done, because that's the history of philosophy. You can do that with Star Trek. You know, I think we're so nostalgic for the original series, or The Next Generation, or Voyager for me, and whatnot. You can go, oh man, why aren't they doing Star Trek like they used to do Star Trek, you know? Mm-hmm. We can do that with our podcast, you know, look at all these great topics we've already covered. And, you know, you have to look forward, you know, philosophical. You have to go, okay, great, there's all these open philosophical questions from the history of philosophy, movements in the history of philosophy, rationalism and empiricism and existentialism. And okay, that brings us up to the present, but it's not like human thought is done. So what's happening today? What's happening tomorrow? What's happening in the future? You can do that in your life. Like, okay, we're halfway through the journey of life. You're middle-aged. I'm approaching middle-aged. You can go, oh, okay, look at all this life that's gone. Look how few days are ahead. There's more days behind than there are ahead. But you have to go, what's happening today? And keep looking forward. And I think what was refreshing to me is the way in which the dramatic themes in Picard were woven together with all of these philosophical themes and references and issues kind of interwoven in a very small number of episodes. And it's such a delicate balance to find, because it's like you've got a couple of tuning knobs. You've got the kind of character tuning knob. You got to make sure you have enough character development and character moments. You have to have enough plot to keep everyone interested in modern television, and you want to make it relevant socially and culturally and politically, and all of that has to be going on all in a very, you know, a short amount of space. And it's just got to be really hard to find the balance between those things. And I was just impressed that they managed to weave in so much philosophical material into 10 episodes.
Yeah, and speaking of characters and character development, we get a whole cast of new characters in Star Trek Picard. And those characters, I've heard a lot of conversations, a lot of discussion about how they're unique in the Star Trek universe. And specifically, it's the brokenness of these characters that I hear people say, wow, this is, you know, this is unique. This is something we haven't seen before. And it really is. I mean, we've gotten characters before who were very broken. Seven of Nine comes to mind immediately. Who
in Voyager, Tom Paris and B'Elanna.
Tom Paris, when we meet him, is very broken. For that matter, when we first meet Deanna Troi against Will Riker, you know, we suddenly discover that they have a past and there's a history there, and they've got to somehow get past that. I mean, yeah, we've not seen characters who were broken in a a very, you know, gritty sort of sense. But, you know, the ideas of addiction and brokenness, and we've seen these themes before in Star Trek, but I think that we're getting them in kind of new, fresh ways, and we're exploring it maybe in a more gritty fashion, I think, is what people find interesting. But in the midst of all of that exploration, we really get some wonderful philosophical ideas and explorations into, you know, how it is that somebody goes from being an idealistic, optimistic Starfleet officer to becoming someone like we meet in the character of Rios.
A broody existentialist.
Yes, a brooding existentialist. Yes, yes, absolutely.
Not in a very good sense. He doesn't understand existentialism, no, I don't think.
No, he certainly doesn't. But I think he's working on it. And
and isn't, he's missing isn't the whole
that
point.
True of, isn't that true of all of us, though? We're all just kind of working on it.
So that's interesting you mention this, because this is one of the character aspects that a lot of people find compelling, the brokenness and the grittiness. But for me, it always comes across as a little self-indulgent. Like, I really just want to grab the characters, and, you know, like in Moonstruck when Cher slaps Nicolas Cage and says, "Snap out of it." Like, really? Is it that bad in the 24th century? You
know? Yes. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure I'm buying it.
Well, again, gritty and brooding. I think of...
I get the broodiness. I'm a brooder, so I get that.
Yeah, I think of Benjamin Sisko. Can we say that Rios is more broken than Benjamin Sisko was when we first met him in the first season of Deep Space Nine? I don't think so. I think these two men are in their own right are equally broken. It's just, you know, we dealt with it a little differently in 90s television than we do certainly, you know, here in 2020.
Well, the difference is that someone like Sisko still knows that he has to get out of bed and do his job. Even if he's going to go hide on a space station and do his job, he at least has a job and he's going to do it. He doesn't quit.
Yes.
So this seems to be one of the like shift in mindsets for these characters. Like, these are characters that didn't persist. They gave up and they did check out of life, and now they have to be almost forced back into being part of the game of life again.
Right. Right. Dysfunctional families is another kind of interesting thing that people have seemed to gravitate towards in Star Trek Picard. You know, we get to see this kind of dysfunctional family aspect in Star Trek Picard. And again, it's nothing new. I mean, we can go back to some of the, we'll call them the original Star Treks. Now we just lump them all together in original Star Trek.
But you can kind of go, okay, Picard didn't like his brother and didn't like his dad. Okay. Right. You know, what's the difference here?
Right.
Is this really new territory? And more importantly for our show, is this even philosophical territory? Like, all the character things you just described, is that the philosophical content of Picard? What's the takeaway? What's the message? What's the principle?
Right, exactly. And so, again, while I think that a lot of people are kind of wooed by this, you know, this gritty kind of storytelling, it's really, in that regard, Zachary, it's nothing new. There's really nothing new in Star Trek Picard, I think, that we haven't seen before in previous iterations of Star Trek. However, they are giving us, I think, and I guess to my point, they are giving us some fresh takes on some of these ideas. There's some really kind of fresh ways of telling these stories, and they're giving us some interesting new perspectives into not just the stories, but also those wonderful philosophical themes that we've seen woven throughout 52, 53, 54 years of Star Trek storytelling.
I'm also really surprised at how abstract my list of philosophical topics is. You talked about some of these practical, concrete, real life kinds of issues, character and brokenness and whatnot. But there are a lot of really interesting abstract ideas woven in, philosophical and metaphysical and scientific, all interwoven within the story. And I find those just as interesting as anything you just described from a character development standpoint. But before we do that, I do want to hear what's on your list from a philosophical theme standpoint. But I'm curious what your take on Picard was. You know, in a way, I think you and I can relate to Picard. You know, we're not as old, but we're not young anymore either. We're not looking at this as, you know, as 20-year-olds. We're looking at this as 40 and 50-year-olds. So, like, what are we supposed to take away from Picard in terms of the meaning in life or our purpose? Or, you know, how can someone like Picard, who's philosophical by nature anyway, be approaching the end of his life, having checked out for 17 or 18 years, and not be running through these permutations in his mind about what the meaning of life is? And what did all of the accomplishments that he seemed to have achieved and throughout his entire career, what did they all mean when he's basically hiding out on his vineyard and he only has a few, not even years, he's going to die quickly from his brain abnormality.
Right. And so that's
it's like someone who has cancer now, like, okay, I'm going to die in a month. What does it all mean?
Yeah. And so philosophically for me, that seems to be, especially early on, I think we moved away from it once we got to about the midpoint of the season. We still dabble in that territory later on, but especially in those early six episodes, we deal with this idea of identity. And so I think for me, again, especially early on, that was the thing that I gravitated towards the most. And I think, Zachary, it has a lot to do with the fact that I've been thinking a lot about this idea of my own identity and who I have been in the past, who I am now, and who I want to become in the future. And by the way, I think that all of us have a certain amount of control over that. I think that all of us hold within our hands the ability to shape our identity over time. To some degree, there are things that happen that we can't control. Picard is dying. He cannot control that. That's something that's beyond his control. But Picard made a mistake in his past. I think that he's wrestling when we meet him. We don't realize it early on, but he's really wrestling with this decision that he made to gamble his legacy, if you will. This wasn't just his career, Zachary. This was his legacy, doggone it. And he just gambled it. He just rolled it like a, you know, a set of dice. And guess what? He rolled a bust and he's out of the game.
Well, I feel like I'm almost channeling or quoting the French existentialist philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre here. But he would say something to the effect that the first principle of existentialism is you are what you do, right? So
yes.
for years, you know, decades, Picard was Captain Picard. You know, he was on the bridge of a starship, making decisions, having, you know, people respect him, being in command, going on adventures, and that was who he was because that's what he was doing. What's interesting is, and because of that, a historical legacy was built, right? That is his legacy, as you just put it. But you take in Picard, what's interesting is they strip all that away. They take away the starship. They take away the respect. They take away all of his comrades. They take away his position. They like you say, they rolled the dice with his legacy and he ended up with a bust. So you take away all of that, and now Picard is hiding out in his vineyard. So who is Picard? You could plausibly say from an existentialist standpoint, he is what he does. And if he's going to hide out on his vineyard and basically be a coward hiding from life, you know, for the rest of his life and stay checked out, that's who he is because that's what he decided to do. And that is in our control. Right?
He's become Robert.
By choice. Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, he's, you know, now that he's out of Starfleet, it's hard to get back in, as we see in the course of the series. But he didn't have to be hiding out in his vineyard. He could have been challenging himself in other ways, right?
So, well, and I think he says that he is just a man who was hiding out, waiting to die.
Well, this is an interesting you know, almost a paradox of human choice, because at any given moment in your life, you are constrained in some sense by your past, right? You know, you can't change anything that happened to you before, any past decisions you've made. That's just the fact of the matter. You can't go back in time and change those things, right? And those culminate in where you're at right this very moment for everyone. And then there's a sense in which you can be artificially constrained by your past, like, you know, so constrained by your past that you don't see any future possibilities for yourself, don't see that you can make different decisions or do something else with your life, whatever that means for everyone. So there's kind of this healthy way of relating to your past, like, okay, yes, I can't change all of the past, and kind of accepting it for what it is, but also being willing to transcend it by looking forward. And there's a healthy and an unhealthy way to look forward. Like, the unhealthy way to look forward is like, I've got these crazy dreams that are never going to come to fruition because you don't do anything about them, or they're unrealistic. They don't keep in mind the fact of the matter, brute force realities of the present at the same time. And then there's kind of there's a healthy way of looking forward, which is like, okay, at any given moment, you can develop a new skill or change your career or go on an adventure or whatever. You can always do those things. And even when you're at 90, you can do those things, right? So when you kind of artificially box yourself in, that's not a very healthy way of relating to the future. And Picard has kind of done that. He's really boxed himself in into a very narrow vision of what the future can be like for the rest of his life, because he doesn't know what to do with the future without his legacy.
Mm-hmm. So I find that probably the most satisfying for me philosophically is this idea of identity. And it's, by the way, it's not just Picard's identity that we're dealing with. And Picard is really interesting in that I don't think that we're dealing with a singular identity. I think Picard sees his life, there's a multiplicity, if you will, if I can use.
Well, he's a stranger to himself. He's been a stranger to himself many times, as he says.
Yeah, absolutely. He sees himself as, you know, the starship guy. I think in many ways he still sees himself on the bridge of the Enterprise. And I love the fact that we see post Nemesis, he continues to do what we know Jean-Luc Picard does the best. You know, yeah, so Riker goes off. He's, you know, he's the captain of the Titan, and, you know, everybody, Data's gone, and everybody's kind of gone their separate. Worf's not there, and so on and so forth. But he begins to invest himself in. He's got this relationship with Raffi, I think, that's really interesting. And that's this father-daughter kind of relationship that he has with her. And you know, so he continues to be that version of himself, I think, that that he feels most comfortable with. And certainly he has that kind of relationship with Elnor, although I don't believe that we got to explore that enough. So there again, he's this fatherly sort of figure, you know, to Elnor. But then beyond that, you know, he's made this mistake. But I think that there's another identity here that he's struggling with, and we don't really realize it, I think, enough. But we got to explore it just a little bit in the interactions that he had with Seven of Nine, and that is this idea that he was Locutus of Borg. And so we see that he's still haunted by this, and he still struggles with the role that he played in Wolf 359, and you know, that how that all has kind of haunted him. And so there's this identity issue that we have with him. But then each of the characters in their own right, Seven, Nine, I just mentioned, I think for her, this first season of Star Trek Picard has been largely about identity. For the android Dodge, this is about identity. Raffi, it's a lot about identity. Rios, it's a lot about his identity. Agnes Girardi, she's going to have a crisis of her own in the midst of Star Trek Picard, and that is the
assuming
fact
they
that
don't put her in irons. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, she's committed a murder, and so, you know, I love the way they wrote her throughout this series, because there were moments when I wasn't sure if she playing ball with the Romulans. So from a storytelling standpoint, and I'm a storyteller, I really appreciate the fact that she was shrouded in a lot of mystery for a long time. And it really didn't all shake out until, you know, literally the last episode. You know, you finally, at least I think we figured out, you know, where she falls on the spectrum of things. But, you know, maybe we're still not sure. But again, it's this question of identity. Elnor, certainly, I think there's, he's kind of this coming of age sort of character. And so I think this is a strong philosophical theme, and certainly Data, you know, we get to explore his identity, although
or whatever, whatever simulation of Data we get from a recreation of him based on one of his neurons.
Yes. Yes. Right.
Not sure I fully understand how that works, but
so that to me is this thread I find very prevalent and very strong throughout this entire season, and certainly most prevalent in those first six or so episodes.
Well, it's a theme, but what's the takeaway? Like we see that Rios he's supposed to be an existentialist character in some sense, right? He's reading existentialist literature. He's listening to LPs. He's smoking cigars. He's kind of dark. He pulls shrapnel out of his own shoulder. So what do we make of him as a character? And for any of them, for that matter, they've all had something bad happen to them. They all have, right? So, but Rios has really taken this dark, broody direction. Yeah. And I find the references to existentialism fascinating because they keep dropping it. There's the book that he's reading by some existentialist philosopher.
Right.
Is it Rafi that says this dark existentialist broody thing is not going to work?
Yes. And I knew that you would jump on that.
Well, it's because it misses the entire point of existentialism. Like, existentialism is not supposed to be a negative, dark philosophy, right? It's supposed to be kind of a life-affirming reaffirmation of your own free will, your own ability to decide what kind of life to live, you know, get out of that, you know, slump and go out in the world and do something. And yeah, so what, something happened to you in the past, you can transcend it by doing something in the future. It's supposed to be full of possibilities and liveliness and forward looking. And for some reason, it's twisted in Rios's mind into this dark, broody, negative, death-based, some philosophical concept, like this weird bastardization of existentialism bent into something dark.
Yeah.
Like a lot of 20th century culture was called existentialist, you know, beat poetry or, you know, beatniks or, you know, those cigarette smoking rebels that are disaffected by everything. They were all kind of culturally called existentialist, but they all kind of collectively missed the positive, optimistic part of existentialism, which is this life-affirming focus on your own free will to define your own life.
You didn't see the James Dean poster on the wall in Rios's quarters?
Are you joking? Is there really a James Dean poster there?
No. But I could totally see one. I think they should probably incorporate that into season two.
Season two. So I was really bothered by this portrayal of existentialism because I think it reinforces this view that people have about existentialism that really fundamentally deeply misses the point of what existentialist philosophers were trying to say about our own finitude and our own free will and our own relationship to our future demise in the form of our death, whether it's next week or 50 years from now. You know, they're all kind of collectively saying you can make life what you want it to be because you've got free will in the here and now.
And I think that probably is, at least for me, Zachary, the big takeaway. I think at the end of this, in many ways, each of these characters discovered that the power to change was really in their own hands. I think each of them,
with a little help from their friends, as the Beatles might say.
With a little help from their friends. Now, although that doesn't follow the whole kind of beatnik James Dean sort
Well, of. It's actually kind of, I'm thinking about this just now on the fly, but it's actually kind of Aristotelian in nature. Like Aristotle thought that our potential is, embedded in us in some way. Mm-hmm. He used the classic example that kind of everyone knows of the acorn developing into the oak tree,
right?
An acorn has the potential to develop into an oak tree, but it takes a lot of stuff. It takes watering and soil and pruning and nourishment and cultivation, in other words. You do need someone to cultivate those things. And that's Aristotle's view of education and character, is that, yeah, we've got all this potential, but it's not the kind of thing you can do on your own. It takes training and mentorship and friendship and society and government and politics to reinforce, to provide a sustainable cultivating environment within which people can flourish to reach their full potential. And that's arguably what's happening in Star Trek in general, right? People reach their full potential because all of society and all of the people in that society have been structured in such a way that people naturally tend to develop towards the best versions of themselves because of all these external societal cultivating factors. But left to their own devices, people don't naturally develop to their full potential. Like, you take a person and put them off in the woods and let them sit in the woods for 50 years, they're not going to reach their full potential. It's like an acorn that's never watered, right? It's not going to develop properly.
Right.
So, you know, this aspect, the idea that all of these people have been kind of, they've checked out of life and they're kind of living this individualistic life. Rios on his ship and Raffi out in the desert and Picard on his vineyard. These are like little Aristotelian acorns not being watered, not able to reach their potential because they're not being social, political, rational, maybe existentialist animals like Aristotle thought they were.
Well, again, I mean, if we look at each of these characters individually, you know, I think about Soji, for instance. You know, she's got a choice to make. Is she going to capture the legacy of Data, or is she going to be the destroyer? I think for Jurati, I think, you know, when we meet her, she's in an empty lab and she's just kind of going through the motions. She's not really doing what she loves anymore. She's just basically caved to what has become her life's passion, because, you know, it's in many ways she probably feels like it's been taken from her, and she's given this opportunity to go out and recapture that thing that she loves, and that's her work, her research. So all of these characters, I think, have to I don't want to use the word existential choices, but, you know, in many, many ways they are.
Well, Soji is an interesting character that you just mentioned, because to me, it's a great example of the power of external voices to define who you are. Like, on the one hand, she's being told you could be the destroyer, and Picard is another voice, you know, maybe like the other sitting on her other shoulder, yeah. Like the devil and the angel saying, no, you can make the right decision. No, you're going to be the destroyer. Right. And, you know, I think educators have this power. Parents have this power. If you tell someone, you know, you're worthless, you're not going to amount to anything, people are going to internalize that. And if you say you're amazing, you can accomplish anything, people are going to internalize that, and they're going to do awesome things with their lives, right? Yeah. Those external voices can really be internalized, you know, psychologically. And Soji's a great example of that, because she's only 3 years old, and she's come to realize she's only 3 years old, and her future, she doesn't know what her future is going to be. She barely knows who or what she is, even.
Right.
And she's got eventually to decide, you know, which voices she listens to and which voices she ignores, and still under this broad existentialist umbrella of, you know, ultimately choosing what to be.
And Zachary, I would imagine that you would find this personally satisfying, being the Voyager wonk, 7 of 9, and how she fits into this, and frankly, how she's still trying to figure herself out.
Yeah, playing Calto with Raffi, no less, at the very end.
Yeah, she's still trying to figure out who she is. You know, again, it's this question of identity. And there's that moment there when she has to make a choice, or it feels that she's forced to make a choice to take upon herself the mantle of Borg Queen. And, you know, is she going to come back from that? And
well, I have to admit, I have a hard time understanding how we get from the 7 of 9 that we saw in Voyager, even at the end of Voyager, to the 7 of 9 we see at the beginning of Picard. Picard, I understand. Like, okay, he, you know, gambled with his career and he lost, and he's got this vineyard, and we knew all that already. Okay. 7 of 9, you know, she had a pretty good character development arc. She does have her Voyager family. We don't really know yet what happened to everyone, but presumably they're not all dead. So where did they go? Like, why is Seven of Nine out there on the frontier, you know, policing the former neutral zone? Mm-hmm. You know, why that? And as I was thinking about it, the only thing that comes to mind is that, you know, she has this deep need to make order out of chaos. And for some reason, her own life got thrown into chaos. Clearly, the neutral zone was thrown into chaos with the destruction of mm-hmm. Romulus. And as I was thinking about this, preparing for the show, the connection to me that came to mind was the Stoic philosopher and emperor of Rome, Marcus Aurelius.
Aurelius, yes.
He, in a very poetic part of his meditations, he said that we all do our little part to make order out of the universe. You know, the birds and the bees and the spiders and all the living creatures on the planet get up every single morning and they do their little part. They build their spider webs or build their nests, or the ants build their ant colonies. You know, there's constantly making order out of a chaotic universe, right? Even though the whole universe is arguably decaying because of entropy and the finitude of things. And, you know, everyone knows the kind of everything turns to dust aspect of Stoicism. But, you know, Marcus Aurelius seemed to be saying that we fight against that. You know, even when the world is massively chaotic, even if it looks meaningless, even if we know that our projects are going to be forgotten and our accomplishments will be forgotten, we still get up every day. We should at least get up every day and try to build order out of whatever chaotic universe we find ourselves in. And, you know, you could see how you could have that view as a Roman emperor, all the chaos and the constant threats to his empire and threats to his own life, how chaotic it must be being a Roman emperor. And every day he's got to get up and try to do the right thing as an emperor. Seven of Nine is kind of in the same position. Like, somehow her life got thrown into chaos. All the relationships she built on Voyager don't seem to be present anymore. Somehow she finds herself in the neutral zone in this chaotic mm-hmm. environment. She does the only thing she knows how to do as a Borg, which is try to make order out of chaos, just like a spider getting up and spinning its web every day.
Yes. Yeah. And so for me, that makes her decision to place herself in the uncomfortable position of rejoining the collective and bringing that Borg collective together, because it is her baser drive to make order out of chaos. And so I think that's really interesting, and how she ends up where we find her at the beginning of Picard. I can kind of draw that line. It's all speculative, but I can draw that line. I think her character journey through Picard, at least so far, has been really interesting, and I'm really fascinated to see how far they'll explore it. Because I think there is an interesting story there to be told regarding her past, that post Voyager, pre Picard life that she's lived.
Well, they're trying to tie it to the death of Icheb, right, which was a traumatic experience. And like many traumatic experiences, they can knock you into chaos, right? Mm. So is that adequate to account for where Seven is at? Because she was already kind of playing bounty hunter, yeah. You know, by the time we see Icheb's death, the flashback to Icheb's death in Picard. So something must have happened, and maybe they'll explain it in the next season. Maybe they won't. Maybe they'll just take for granted that's who Seven of Nine is now. I hope they try to tie it together a little more, because it just doesn't make sense yet to me. And for Seven of Nine, who's constantly seeking order, to me it seems like if that's the driving force, which she kind of says as much. She says as much that she's trying to kind of police the chaotic environment of the former neutral zone. Mm-hmm. It's such a bad way to go about it. Wouldn't joining Starfleet or being a bit more, you know, part of society be a better way to build order? This is the difference between Stoics and Cynics, right? In classical Greek philosophy, Hellenistic philosophy, the Cynics were the ones who checked out of society, right? And the Stoics were the ones who were like, no, you, it's good to be an individual, but you still have to be part of society. Just don't give, you know, over importance to things and keep everything in perspective, but don't check out of society. She's almost taking the route of a Cynic, trying to escape the chaos, maybe even creating more chaos in the process. Like the Cynics would, you know, walk around dirty and they purposely wouldn't bathe, and they'd, you know, flagrantly violate all the social conventions, you know, almost like, you know, dirty hippies wandering around aimlessly. You know, they were purposely going against the grain, and Seven seems to have to kind of be taking more of that approach. You know, she's purposely almost causing more chaos than she's solving.
Well, and I think there's something more going on within the Federation, Zachary, that we probably don't really see. They hint to it, I think, a couple of times here in Picard. But I think in many ways the Federation is in much more dire straits than probably what we realize. And for me, that is...
Even though they have a fleet of 220 of the biggest, fastest, best ships.
Yeah, and how...
Led by acting Captain Riker.
Yeah, yeah. That was sensational, to say the least.
You can't, the Federation can't be doing too bad if they were able to get that fleet together, right?
Yeah, well, exactly. And so that kind of goes a little bit to my point, because early on we're given the idea that something's very wrong in the Federation. And in fact, in the first couple of episodes, it was almost distasteful to me, because I felt like they were going down the road of the fan film Renegades in many ways. And I was almost sad about that, because I didn't want to see this go that route. I like Renegades for what it is, but I just didn't want to see a CBS knockoff of Renegades. I felt like they could tell a unique story, and they did.
Well, it shows the power of fandom to create what Star Trek actually does become, because, you know, the people who own Star Trek are going to give fans what they want, whatever fans are willing to pay for. So if that's where the winds are blowing, that's what CBS is going to make.
Yes. And I'm a little conflicted at the idea of the Federation being in disarray. I don't want to say disrepair. I don't think it's in disrepair, but I do think that there's some chaos. It's post Dominion War. I think there's some things going on. Certainly if Romulans have somehow infiltrated Starfleet, I think that certainly is a symptom of a much bigger problem. So I think in a broad sense, I think that this is not the Federation of us Voyager DS9 Next Gen era fans. And while that's sometimes a hard pill for me to swallow, it's also, as a writer, as someone who tells stories, it's really interesting.
Well, I guess I don't mind it as long as it's cathartic. If we see the Federation in dire straits at the beginning of the season or the series, and there's some dramatic conflict resulting in some catharsis and eventual resolution and a return to some ideal that we know of as Star Trek, then I'm all for it, right? Because that's drama, right? You get conflict and catharsis and resolution and release. And if the overall arc has that, then I think we can return to the state of normalcy that we think of as Star Trek. And that was all good. I mean, Voyager kind of did that too, with the conflict between the Maquis, sure, and Starfleet, right? That was tense and it wasn't ideal. It was supposed to go against the grain of what Star Trek had been up till that point. And it lasted like a week, of course, because it's Voyager. But that was the idea. It was like they're introducing this dramatic tension into the show. And then it's satisfying when it gets resolved and everyone feels good, right? That's just classical drama, according to Aristotle, right?
Yeah, we got to play with that a little bit more in DS9, though, and that was fun. I think, though, it was Maps and Legends here. I think it was the second episode of Picard. Maybe it was the third episode, The End is the Beginning. But Picard is sitting down for a very rare interview, and he's being pressed by the interviewer and being pushed, and he ends up blowing up, and he says, because of, you know, I did what I did because it wasn't Starfleet anymore. And wow, you know, that was a moment for me. I mean, I had to literally pause because I had to wrap my head around what the implications of that comment could possibly be. And I feel like they backed away from it, from that as the season went on. You know, by the time we get to episode 10 and that mighty fleet of futuristic starships shows up, I feel like we've got the Starfleet of old.
With no lights on the bridges either, because that's a thing now in Star Trek. They don't actually turn the lights on anymore.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Everything's dark and broody. And
even the ships are dark and broody.
You mentioned earlier, though, you mentioned the death of Icheb. And I want to take a moment of silence for Icheb. No, I'm kidding. That was tough for me. Icheb. The Borg kids are not popular characters in Star Trek fandom.
I don't know why not. But why do people hate on things like that?
I don't know. I liked Icheb. We consider Manu a friend here on Metatrex. We've had him.
Absolutely.
We've had him on and got to hear some amazing stories about doing Voyager, and Manu's a great guy. So that was kind of a tough pill for me to swallow. Tough to see another actor playing Manu, and that's politics we don't have to get into here. But you know, just the character, there's a certain connection there, and that was hard. But we also saw that you know, the death of Bruce Maddox. You know, we got this kind of interesting one-off character from Next Generation who really, in many ways, plays a major role.
Again, here, not played by the same actor.
Not played by the same actor.
Because that's a thing now as well.
Yeah, interesting. But let's talk about mortality for a minute, because this is kind of one of those interesting themes in Star Trek Picard as well. Not only do we see the death of... They're minor characters, Zachary, but... I don't feel like they were so minor that those deaths weren't they weren't meaningful.
Did you shed a tear over Bruce Maddox, Mike? Is that what you're saying?
I had a moment of silence. For
a
Bruce
solitary
Maddox.
Vulcan tear.
Yes, it was a Vulcan tear, but again, you know. I mean, this
a Vulcan
is,
tier for Maddox. Yeah.
But, you know, and I guess it goes to the power of the storytelling in Next Generation. You know, when Measure of a Man begins, Bruce Maddox is the villain of that episode. But by the end of the episode, we have that moment where we really see Data through his eyes. And even though... He was, I think even
he,
though...
He never had bad intentions.
No, his intentions weren't bad. I think his intentions, Zachary, were actually good. I think he had good intentions. And I think, I know, because we understand that at the end of the episode, he admires Data. There's a value he's placed on Data. He thinks that Data is something special.
Well, I think he always thought that from the beginning, but what at the beginning of the Measure of a Man, he didn't actually see Data as a person.
He sees him as a thing.
Yeah, an amazing special thing.
Yes.
You know, a shiny toy, but not a person.
But by the end of the episode, he's completely changed his position. And we get that. And so...
And by the time Data's day comes around, they're pen pals.
Yeah, yeah. So I think for me, Maddox is a character that I'm interested in. And I'm saddened by his death, because I think there was something there to be explored. I think that there were stories there that could have been told. And I honestly would have liked to have seen him. So... You know, his death meant something. But then we have a Picard who's dying, and doggone it, they did it to me again. Spoiler alert, I had to relive all over again the death of a character that really was special to me, Data. And I did, Zachary, and I'm man enough to admit this. I did get choked up.
I did too, but I feel like this approach to drama, and we're veering away from the philosophical topics a little bit, but it's our show.
Not really, we're talking about mortality, and we're talking about the meaning of life. And I
guess I just find this a cheap way to create drama. Like, you know, there's more to interesting storytelling and there's more to drama than death and getting over it and death and getting over it and death and getting over it. Like, this is just a cheap way to create drama and interest, I think. But
you're telling me that when and Brent Spiner, if you're listening to this, doggone it, man, you still got it. That speech in part two of that finale, you mean to tell me that you didn't have philosophical goosebumps at Data's speech at the end of that episode?
I think the part that really did move me, yes, there's the emotional connection to Data, but I think the part that moved me philosophically, because it is a very classically stoic insight, this reference to the butterfly, a butterfly that lives forever just isn't a butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and this, of course, is in keeping with Rios's broody existentialist book about death, right? In some sense, our reality is defined by our mortality. It's what reason we have to get out of bed and actually live life, because we know that it doesn't last forever. And that should be a motivating factor for life. And if we did wake up and find ourselves immortal, like Picard very well could have woken up and found himself immortal as a synthetic Picard, right? Synth Picard. What motivation could you possibly have to do or accomplish anything in life if it literally doesn't matter and you're going to live forever, right? So I think there's something just foundational about human life and its finitude, right? You know, that's why we're motivated. That's why the present moment is special. That's why we know special moments come and go, right? Because we know that they're, you know, at some point we're going to be blinked out of existence, presumably, mm-hmm. or live on in a, you know, heavenly afterlife or a platonic heaven if you're Plato. But for the rest of us, you know, we only have so many days and years. And I think it's an interesting question. Would you really want to live an immortal life? Like, Data could have lived an immortal life. Turns out he didn't either. But they could have created Picard to be more like Data and functionally live forever unless something happens to him. I think it's telling that Picard doesn't want to live an immortal life like Data could have lived had Data not been, you know.
Yeah, because Data's talking about the fact that the value of life is in its being finite.
Yeah, he can't be a real life, you know, human like person unless he's finite. Yeah,
and so I honestly would have imagined in that moment you would have had philosophical chills, because that was
I did a little bit.
There was this beautiful kind of stoicism, but it was gold. It just, for me philosophically, it was gold. And all the emotional aspects of it aside, you know, the connection I have emotionally to the character of Data, all of that aside, philosophically, it was so well written, just incredibly insightful and thoughtful. And really in that moment, it had me thinking about, you know, my life and how I spend those minutes and what that means going forward.
Although I have to say, I think I sympathize a little more with Picard's statement after he's already turned into a synth that he would have liked another 10 or maybe even 20 extra years, you know. I think I agree with Picard a little more that, you know, choosing to live a little longer is better than choosing to die. So
I agree. And by the way, that probably should have gotten into our little discussion about identity, because that changes the game, I think, a little bit for Jean-Luc Picard. We have to now ask the question, you know, is he Jean-Luc Picard? You know, is this a ship of Theseus problem here?
Oh, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's the transporter problem. Like, you know, if you destroy one person and rebuild a copy of them, is it right? The same person or not, right? Is it just a duplicate? Have you killed the original and now you've got a, you know, functionally identical duplicate? Or, again, we're delving into some metaphysics now. If your consciousness is somehow an emergent property, either arising from the input-output relations that define your consciousness, you know, in some quantitative sense, or if it's some sort of emergent qualitatively different property from some, you know, emergent potential of the you know, the material that makes up your brain. If you destroy that original copy and then take that exact same thing, the exact same functional relationships or the exact same emergent whatever, and recreate that somewhere else, this is the big question, right? Is it the same thing? Have you literally created the same person? Because the emergent property is the same. Or the functional network is the same, you know, and like if you have two computers that are identical, like they're gonna have the exact same phenomenal manifestations based on the fact they work the same way. But that's the question: are they copies, or is it literally the same person being instantiated because you've recreated the substrate that makes that person possible?
Yeah, and so I think we're getting two different answers to that, because we know that basically, Soji, by extension, in many ways, is a copy of Data. In many ways, Data lives on in her. And I think it's fascinating that she's treated as...
Well, or a copy of Data lives on in her. Exactly. Which is it?
And they're not, I don't think they're entirely clear about that.
Well, even at the very end, when we're actually supposed to be talking to Data, right? It's not totally clear, because he says this is just a simulation, but I'm really the Data, because this is my, it was made from this duplicate of that was made from one of Data's original whatever.
Right.
It's like, wait a minute, does that mean it's really Data, or is it just a copy of Data? Is it a simulation of Data? Is it? And this is the part that just,
it's a little muddy.
And I think the bit about duplicates doesn't bother me too much. It's not even very interesting philosophically, because it's well trodden territory in Star Trek. We know about the transporter problem. We know about transporter duplicates. This is all well trodden stuff. This is just a new way of telling that. Now you've got,
but again, back to my earlier statement at the top of this episode, you know, I talked about, you know, we're going back and we're re-exploring familiar territory, but we're doing it in interesting new ways. And I certainly think this is an interesting new way to explore that problem.
Well, where I see the novelty in philosophical novelty in Picard is this bit about an entire being's consciousness or essence residing within even one of Data's neurons. Okay, so all of Data is somehow contained in his neurons. Okay, well, I'm trying to think about what that means. I was thinking about it in terms of the overall mind-body problem. Like, this is one of the big problems in philosophy. How exactly do you get mental properties, consciousness, intentionality, perception, from a bunch of matter that doesn't seem to have those properties, right? Our brains, you know, the individual neurons in our brains don't seem to be conscious. It's the combination of them that yields some new property, consciousness and intentionality and perception and subjectivity, right? Where the constituent parts of the brain don't seem to have those qualities.
Dualism, my friend, dualism.
Well, right. So now you can look at the range of possible responses to this. One approach is that there are just, like you said, dualism, like two completely different substances, mental substances and physical substances, and they're somehow conjoined together in a person in our brain, right? I think that's really problematic, and it sounds problematic, and it is problematic because it doesn't do justice to the fact that our brains seem to give rise to consciousness, right?
I knew I would strike a chord with that.
Well, and then there are these kind of middle positions, like, okay, maybe there is no separate kind of property. Maybe they're just labels we give to physical properties of the brain, and we call it intentionality, we call it subjectivity, we call it consciousness, but it really is just a bunch of neurons firing. Again, that doesn't do justice to the qualitative difference between the physical matter of our brains and all this subjectivity. could be some sort of emergent property, like, you know, in the combination of a complex of complex components arranged in complex ways, you get new properties that emerge, just like water gives rise to wetness when you put enough H2O molecules in the, you know, together in the right way. It could be that consciousness, that all the mental states we have, like, you know, intention, deciding something or intending something or desiring something or feeling something, that those are really just a complex network of input-output relationships, and that's all there is to it. So there's all these positions trying to figure out what the relationship is between the mental and the physical, philosophically. One view that does not get a lot of attention is called panpsychism. And the view is basically that rather than saying there's higher level physical higher level mental properties and lower level physical properties, it tries to say that as you go farther and farther and further down the physical spectrum to the fundamental constituents of matter, that there are mental properties that even the most fundamental constituents of matter have. So it's not that you have inanimate, non-conscious physical pieces of matter that somehow give rise to, you know, to mental properties in some complex systems, is that even the constituent components of anything in the physical world, tables, chairs, brains, neurons, gray matter, whatever, quarks, electrons, that all of those have either something, some mental property or some proto-mental property that's written into the very fabric of physical reality. It's called panpsychism, meaning mental properties everywhere. That's what the pan prefix means, that it's almost like mental properties are a fundamental property of matter in the same way that things we normally think of as physical properties like mass or electrical charge are properties of matter. It tries to say, no. It's not that the mental is in some special domain or mental only arises in complex systems. Even the constituents themselves have mental components. And so this idea that Dage's consciousness is somehow contained even in a single neuron is a really interesting take on this view of philosophy of mind that's not very popular and doesn't give a lot of press because it sounds wildly implausible to think that an electron has some mental component to it. But what it tries to do is collapse the distinction between the mental and physical. It basically says, well, if the constituent components of the physical world themselves have mental properties, then there is no problem about how complex systems gives rise to mental properties because mental properties exist even in the most fundamental components of matter. Again, it strikes me as wildly implausible, and I don't see, you know, what possible mental properties could an electron have or a single neuron have. I don't think that really does justice to how we think of the mental being something fairly complex, but it does try to eliminate the distinction in the same way that radically physicalist philosophers of mind try to just eliminate the mental. They just say, well, there's no mental, so the mind-body problem goes away. There's just brain stuff and neurons firing, and we might call it consciousness. They're basically rejecting the idea that there's anything mental, and so they get rid of the distinction and solve the problem. Panpsychism tries to take the other approach. It says there is no mind-body problem because there's mental properties all the way down. So there is no problem of how matter gives rise to the mental because there's mental written into the very fabric of reality.
Yeah, it's certainly fascinating. And again, I think it's a new, exploration of something very familiar in the Star Trek universe.
Well, I think
we've discussed this many times here on MetaTrack.
It's a not very popular avant-garde philosophy of mind that doesn't get a lot of press that it's really interesting to see Star Trek exploring. I want to get back to Bruce Maddox for just a minute. I think the death of Bruce Maddox is an interesting, maybe it's not interesting because it's fairly classical. You know, Girardi's murder of Maddox is basically an example of consequentialist ethics in play, right? She has convinced herself that if she doesn't kill Bruce Maddox, then some terrible disaster, the elimination of all biological life in the galaxy or the universe or the fill in the blank, is going to occur. So she kills Maddox to prevent this future disaster. It's basically the trolley problem. You kill one person to save six people or 10 people or 100 people or 1,000 people. And on a consequentialist viewpoint, that's the right thing to do, right? If you're trying to maximize pleasure and happiness and minimize pain and suffering for the greatest number of people, then killing the one person to save the rest of the biological universe is arguably the right thing to do. So, you know, so no wonder she doesn't end up in irons because of it by the end of Picard. But
that for me is a problem, Zachary, because and this is a problem that we run into a lot. In the Star Trek universe, and frankly, we run into this problem a lot just in entertainment in general. We just don't often enough see the consequences for actions. There's a one-off line about her turning herself in at, you know, at the next starbase, but beyond that, you know, we get to the end of the series, and she's flying off into the sunset with her new crew, and there are no real consequences for these actions. And I think that's an issue.
No, she gets demoted to captain and gets her own starship. That's what happens when you break the rules in Star Trek, isn't it?
Oh, is her name Kirk?
I'm not sure Star Trek's messaging about the consequences of breaking the rules is actually very healthy when you think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. That was certainly it. Again, not super high on my list, but you know this.
Well, it's there's nothing new to it.
Question of consequentialism is its a problem.
It's a good example of consequentialist ethics. You know, it's a good kind of, you know, space version of the trolley problem. But I'm not sure it adds anything really new to the discussion either.
And not to jump around, but one point that I did want to make about Picard being a synth at the end. And I'm not sure what that does.
He drinks synthahol, by the way, now.
Yeah, no more Chateau Picard. It's all synthahol.
Yeah, Chateau Picard is rebranding. They're selling synthahol now.
But all kidding aside, I think that I really had a problem with it at the end of episode 10. It didn't leave a very good taste in my mouth until I sat down and watched an interview with Shay Bonn and Alex Kurtzman, where they were talking about this was kind of where they were wanting to go. And they really kind of explained why this was their kind of end game for this season from the very beginning, was to make Picard really the poster child for...
He's got to walk the walk, right?
He's got to walk the walk. And in that regard, I can see why, as creators, as writers, they did it. But it's a hard pill for me to swallow. Philosophically, I don't think it added a great deal.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just one of those things you get in science fiction. Like, okay, you got to swallow the pill. Picard's synthetic now. So what? His body's functionally the same. His mind is the same, unless he's a duplicate. But they've kind of said he's not a duplicate. It's the real Picard. It's not duplicate Picard. So what? You know, the weirdest part of the job, as they said in Voyager.
I think it will make for some interesting storytelling to see, perhaps in season two, as he interacts maybe with some of his former shipmates, people who knew him, who loved him, who served with him, how they might react or respond, how I think there's some interesting ethics.
It's going to be all the rage. Plays. They're all going to want to go synthetic now. We're going to get synthetic Riker, synthetic Troy, synthetic Geordi, synth Worf.
I think...
Today is a good day to die. Do you remember the old Twilight Zone episode where it's possible to swap out your body, and there's this old elderly couple, and they've saved all their money, and they go to the body shop, essentially, and they're looking at all these models of the new bodies they can get, and they're going to transfer their consciousnesses to the new bodies. So this is not a new idea. Like, this is from the 60s, the Twilight Zone, right? And turns out they don't have enough money, and they can only at the twist at the end of the episode, like at the end of every Twilight Zone episode, there's always a, you know, little twist. The twist is they don't have enough money for two, and they have to decide which one of them gets the new body, and the other person can't get the new body. So, This is what bothers me a little bit. It's not like this is really new territory. It's kind of like there's an Emperor's New Clothes quality to it. It looks shiny and new, but these are some old science fiction tricks that are being dragged out yet again.
But I think it speaks to the fact that these are still conceptually interesting ideas, and I think they
We're no closer to solving the problems than they were in the 60s. And
we really aren't, but they still pique our philosophical curiosities, and I think that's fascinating.
Well, this is something that bothers me a little bit, and it's one of the core issues in philosophy of mind, is that the hard problems in philosophy of mind seem really, really hard to solve. Like, neuroscience has gotten much better. You know, they're getting really good at poking the brain and predicting what's going to happen. They're getting really good at figuring out which parts of the brain are associated with which phenomena. But contemporary philosopher David Chalmers has called that the easy problem of philosophy of mind, the easy problem of consciousness, like making these correlations between the brain and the phenomena. That's easy. Neuroscience is getting really good at that. The hard problem is explaining why exactly matter gives rise to subjectivity in the first place. How exactly does gray matter in the brain and a bunch of electrical sparks in your neurons give rise to personality and subjectivity and perception and intentionality and these qualitatively distinct features of consciousness? And neuroscience is no closer to solving that problem, no matter how good it gets at drawing correlations between consciousness and parts of the brain. So these problems seem really, really intractable and hard to solve. And the fact that it's still philosophically interesting is somewhat troubling, because it shows that philosophy of mind and neuroscience hasn't made as much progress in the last 60 years as neuroscientists would like to think, right? They, you know, no matter how good they get at poking the brain, they're no closer to explaining why exactly the brain gives rise to consciousness in the first place. So I find that kind of interesting. You know, these are old scientific tricks, and we do still find them interesting because these features are still mysterious, because so little progress has been made in philosophy of mind in 60 years.
So, Zachary, I pose a question to you. What are your philosophical disappointments with Star Trek Picard Season 1?
You know, I don't know how to put this. I don't know if I have philosophical disappointments, because we have a pretty long list of stuff we talked about. So if anything, I was philosophically surprised by how rich Picard really was. I think my overall disappointment with Picard is that I am fundamentally not a plot-driven fiction fan. I don't care for mystery novels. I don't care for long story arcs. I don't care for intricate plot twists.
I'm going to pretend you're saying none of this.
Yeah, and I think people felt like Haley is a plot-driven. She loves mystery novels and likes these things, and you're like that, and I just am not. I don't sort of get off on those things. I like character, and I like ideas, and I like kind of talky, slow Star Trek. A lot of my favorite movies are kind of slow, talky kind of movies. Maybe broody existentialist. Yeah. but
I like those things as well, but I like for them to serve a plot.
Yeah, and I guess I find the plot elements kind of distracting at a certain point. I want more discussion on those things. I want a slower pace dealing with these issues. It's not even fair to say that, because Rios's character is, you know, they dwell on these things quite a bit. He's sitting there brooding and reading his existentialist books, and it's very slow-paced.
He's a 24th century James Dean. He's a 24th century James Dean.
Right, he is. And I got a lot of that material from Picard. You know, I got my slow talky fix from it. But if anything, then I was thrown back into Borg story arcs, where it's like, okay, I don't really care so much about that. I'm with you. I don't really care so much about that. I want to get back to the interesting conceptual character-driven stuff, and I want a lot more actual discussion. Like, when I think of Star Trek The Next Generation, for example, I think of, you know, four people sitting in Captain Picard's ready room for a fairly long 4-minute scene, you know, where they're kind of hashing through all the different ways of looking at it, and it's like philosophy as performance art. You know, it's almost like not exactly a monologue, but it's like a Greek chorus of different ways of looking at something, all acted out for you in a bottle scene. And you get a little bit of that, Picard. I guess I was just hungry for the implicit things that we feel the need to talk about on Metatrex, which is great because it gives us, you know, fodder for us to talk about. But I want some of the kind of thing we do on Metatrex conceptually to be written into the show in dialogue form dramatically. And we did get a little bit. You can't help but have some of that with Patrick Stewart and with the writing and these philosophical topics that are brought up. And some of it was very satisfying, like the scene with Picard and Data at the end. But, you know, honestly, it's like, okay, Data wants to die, and Picard has to leave for some reason to get into his new body. And why aren't they sitting there for, like, 4 hours talking about the meaning of life? Why does Data want to die so quickly, and why does Picard need to get out of there so quickly? Like, why isn't that the moment when you want to slow things down and talk about the meaning of it all, right? Why not do that for an entire episode? Why not have a whole episode where they're talking about the meaning of life and death? Just Picard and Data, two of them, as if it's a you know, one or two man show on stage, like Picard would do on a, or Patrick Stewart would do on stage, right? Like, that's the kind of thing I want more of, but they always, you know, either save it to the very end or they go through it so quickly to get back to the plot stuff, they don't dwell on it enough. But those are the things I find interesting. And I could have a whole hour of that and it would be wonderful. You probably would think it's wonderful too.
Sure.
But they don't give it enough due, I think. You know, they tease you with it. It's like a carrot, like, oh, here's your philosophy stuff. Here's your character stuff. Oh, just kidding. We're going to yank it away and get back to the plot. Like, no, make a whole episode just about that. You know, why do you have to rush those things? Those are the moments to dwell on. So that's my disappointment.
I feel like they did a better job giving it to us in Picard, certainly, than they do Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, by far.
And I'm not criticizing Star Trek Discovery in any way. I think Discovery is what it is, and I'm really looking forward to seeing where we, you know, where we go.
Oh, they're out on the frontier now again, which is always fun in Star Trek. Yeah.
Always fun. But I do feel like they did a better job giving it to us in Picard. I think by extension, I think you're absolutely right. If Patrick Stewart, this is going to be a much more philosophical take on Star Trek.
Well, it's a choice to make too. I mean, you can write these things into the show in dialogue form. That's what The Next Generation did. Or you can create an environment where these kinds of issues come up and leave it to the viewer to write those things into the show in their own minds, like we're doing right now, right? That's a choice they probably made, is to kind of, you know, make it a philosophical show but not be so talky about it like they were in The Next Generation.
Right, right.
It's not a boardroom, right? They still want the stuff to happen in the show.
I did have two disappointments, I think, philosophically, in Star Trek Picard. One of them being something I mentioned at the beginning of...
Don't hold back now, Mike. Give us absolute candor. Don't hold back.
Yeah. Well, okay. That's one of them. Okay. That's one of them. Let me start with absolute candor. That was something I think that was really interesting that we threw out there. It was that proverbial carrot that was being dangled in front of me. I thought, oh, this is going to be interesting. And then it went nowhere.
Oh,
it did nothing.
Okay, I have to disagree because I actually found this really interesting. So for me,
it was like a GNDN conduit. It went nowhere.
No. Okay, that might be true, but I still find it interesting because for me, like I teach philosophy, and one thing that comes up in like an intro to ethics class or an intro to philosophy class is Kantian ethics. And according to Kant, some actions are intrinsically right and intrinsically wrong. And if something's intrinsically right, you do it all the time, no matter what the consequences. And if something's intrinsically wrong, you never do it regardless of the consequences, right? Straight up Kantian rule-based ethics. And if one of the things that's wrong is lying, that means you're forced into absolute candor territory. So Elnor is a really interesting, you know, real life example of this kind of way of living that Kant is talking about, taking something that's morally right and doing it through and through, absolutely never telling even the slightest white lie. And what that might actually look like, you know, it's the kind of thing we all know, that you can't get through life without telling some white lies. If your boss says, hey, how's that project going? You go, oh, it's going great, right? You know, we tell white lies. You know, if your friend says, hey, what did you think of my new novel, right, Mike? You know, I go, that's great, Mike, you know. You have to do that to get through life, right? But
are you trying to tell me something, Zachary?
But Kant would say those things are wrong because they're the amount of lying, which is intrinsically wrong according to Kant. So Elnor is a really Kantian character. Like, even about these tiny little seemingly innocent things that are wrong, but we do them anyway. Elnor's not going to do them. He's just going to tell the truth as he sees it through and through. And, you know, is that a good way to be or a bad way to be? You know, I think from our, you know, somewhat jaded human standpoint, we look at Elnor and go, yeah, what an innocent. He needs to grow up a little bit. He needs to learn that, you know, maybe absolute candor is not always the way to go. He's going to, you know, he's going to piss some people off. But Kant would say, no, Elnor is where it's at. You know, you don't even tell the white lies because lying is wrong through and through, no matter what the consequences are.
Yeah, but not only did we not really get a reasonable picture of what that looks like.
No, it's kind of comical.
An exploration. Yeah. Mm-hmm. For that matter, I'll go a step further and to say that in many ways, the writing of Elnor disappointed me. Not only did we not get, I think, a satisfying exploration of absolute candor, I think we missed the mark in the character altogether. And so that was a disappointment for me. The other big disappointment was this really kind of interesting idea of these ex-Borg. There is this wonderful kind of existential story that they're telling about these ex-Borg on this.
Oh yeah. That's a huge missed opportunity. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was an incredibly fascinating.
That's why we need 22 episodes in the season, not 10,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. And so again, not only did they really fail to satisfy my curiosities philosophically in that exploration, because as I sit down and think about it, this is super fascinating. This is a really interesting topic. I think they could have done something with. But they missed the mark, and for that matter, the way they I'll give it to you for this. I think it was the whole plot thing. You know, they're trying to use this as a plot driver, and it really just
doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't seem to add to the plot at all. Yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. It failed miserably. It failed miserably. So those were my two big disappointments. I think they were huge opportunities, and the possibilities, I think, were incredible, but we really missed the mark.
Yeah, and this is just one of the unfortunate consequences of these short seasons, right? If you have 25 episodes in a season, you can carve out room to go, let's do a whole episode on the XBs. Let's do a whole episode on, you know, a talky episode between Picard and Data about the meaning of life and all these cool ideas. They just don't give themselves enough breathing room to do those things. And
yeah.
Maybe they can make the same amount of money with 10 episodes as they can make with 25, and that's the entire end of the story and why they don't do it. Maybe they really think that a tighter storytelling really does drive the plot-driven story forward, and they don't need those things. But I find that approach to storytelling deeply dissatisfying compared to all the interesting one-off episodes you get in the rest of the history of Star Trek. You know, some of the most interesting episodes of Star Trek to me are these weird bottle shows that don't seem to be directly related to any overall plot, or even in Deep Space Nine, the one-off episodes that aren't really tied to the story arc of Deep Space Nine are some of the most interesting episodes to me. And I think it's just a little sad that kind of storytelling doesn't get the breathing room that it needs to happen.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head. These bottle shows, and you know, I'm an Enterprise guy, so you know, Shuttle Pod 1 comes to mind right away. You know, here was this bottle show that really was just, you know, let's save some money and crank out an episode. And, you know, surprisingly, it has become, I think, a fan favorite for a lot of reasons. But philosophically, it's one of the, in the entire four season run of Enterprise, to me, philosophically, it's one of the episodes that stands out the most.
Yeah. And so, again, this is me not being a plot-driven fiction fan. You know, I just want more of those kinds of moments. I don't need the plot to enjoy the show.
Yeah.
So that's my disappointment. I don't think I have any real disappointments. If anything, I was really surprised at how much philosophical material they packed into 10 episodes. But each one of those things needed a little breathing room to really flourish. And and this is the unfortunate thing for me. It's like I'm finding that when we talk about newer versions of Star Trek, when we've talked about Discovery, even a little bit of Enterprise, and when we're talking about Picard now, I'm almost always saying, boy, it's really cool they brought that up. But they didn't do anything with it. They didn't say anything interesting about it. They didn't go anywhere. They didn't explore it. It's great that they packed it in, but they didn't really dwell on it or have anything to say about it. They didn't add anything new to the discussion. So it's cool because we can fill in the gaps, but I wish that they would dwell on those things in the show more like they used to do in The Next Generation. That's not me being nostalgic for The Next Generation. That's me saying that what The Next Generation did well was carving out the breathing room to have the character interaction serve the philosophical purpose.
But they did stay true to form. They just ask a lot of really good questions and really failed to give us any satisfying answers.
That's all I do. Don't tell anyone. I don't actually have any philosophical views on anything. I just ask questions on the podcast, and I just ask questions in the classroom, and I don't have to commit to anything. So
that's right.
Shh.
That's right.
Don't tell anyone. Oh, secrets out. Drat. They're on to me.
Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about Star Trek Picard Season 1, but this isn't the only thing that we've been discussing on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm.
The Line, a Star Trek Picard podcast.
I like the character, but I would have rather seen Noonien.
Okay, interesting.
Tiebreaker to Clerk Zalagi. That's your new nickname, is Tiebreaker.
Yeah, Chrissy, what do you think? Since Brandon and I think exactly the opposite.
Yeah, that's all right. That's why you got to have three people. It works better.
Earl Grey.
No, I think the hat's going to get bigger, but also double as her spacecraft. It'll unfold, it'll envelop her, and she'll be able to just walk out an airlock and zoom off.
Her personal transporter.
Oh, there it comes. Yeah,
that's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. I like it, Amy.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
For a logic extremist suicide bomber to be shown on screen in Star Trek, blowing up a ship with a high-profile ambassador on it in Sarek, it is doing exactly what Star Trek usually does in terms of bringing something from the real world straight back into the show. And I thought that that was one of the most stark examples of that in Season 1 with Vlatak.
Yeah.
The Ready Room.
This story, Una's book, which is excellent, and the upcoming third season of Discovery, from what we've seen so far, are all at their core commentaries on our present day. They're commentaries on Brexit, they're commentaries on the Trump administration, they're commentaries on the sort of the way that countries and governments around the world are turning their back on globalization and they're becoming insular. And, you know, science fiction has always been about social commentary, and Star Trek has been about social commentary. And so what we're seeing is modern day commentary on the current climate of the world, and that's the reason that these stories are taking the form that they're taking, as far as I see it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Well, check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and most third-party podcast apps. And you can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways that you can mind meld with us. Make it a positive mind meld, okay?
Not one of these Romulan mind melds?
None of this apocalyptic
Or an android mind meld? We're getting lots of alternative mind melds in Picard.
We didn't talk about the android mind melds, but maybe we'll save that for another show.
Sure.
But the best place for our listeners, Zachary, to join us in the larger conversation is on the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the contact form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose Message to a Trek FM Show and select Metatrex. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Well, Zachary, when you're not arguing the finer points of absolute candor with Romulan monks, where can people find you on the interwebs and around Trek FM?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on Trek.fm as co-host of To the Journey, Trek FM show dedicated to Star Trek Voyager, and you're welcome to follow me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Frueling. And how about you, Mike? When you're not down at the body shop picking out a younger body model, hoping to extend your life by an extra 10 or maybe 20 years.
Maybe 20 years, yeah.
Where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, Zachary, certainly you can catch me on Facebook. That's typically where I'm most active. Twitter and Instagram is at cmichael1701. You can also check out my website, cmichaelmorrison.com. And by the way, while you're on Facebook, why don't you stop by and give me a like over on my book page? It's at Guardian of Time Book. Well, if you'd like to keep all our shows coming to you each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of time and latinum to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We'd really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And Zachary, we'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher here at Trek.fm, our executive producers Matthew Rushing and Ken Tripp, Aaron Harvey, our art director, and Richard Marquez, our production manager.
I wouldn't mind getting a hold of one of Chris's neurons, speaking of. I have to ask him about that.
It would probably be a prolific neuron. We would... I feel like we could probably have a whole society.
You think you would donate a neuron or two?
Maybe.
You wouldn't miss them?
Zachary, we also want to give a shout out to our associate producers, Patrick Deflin. You can connect with Patrick. He's on Twitter at MagicDrop5. Kay Shaw, you can find her on Twitter as well at ChocoWeeble. Norman Lau, his Twitter handle is at Starfighter1701, and Mark Walker, at Mark74656. And Zachary, I'd like to once more invite our listeners to discover more about our sponsor, Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. And check out audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Well, thanks everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before. I hope we get Q in season two, though.
I do too. Well, you know, Q's a great outside observer to the human condition, right? Anytime you get a third party character kind of going, well, let's see what you humans are up to, you know, on The Next Generation, that was Q. In Deep Space Nine, that was the Ferengi. Interesting, that was Quark standing back, yes, saying, you know, here's all the weird things humans do that don't make sense.
Yes. Yeah. For sure.
Q. Red alert.